to Freedom Beam, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working? Diana, Randy, Michael?
Hey, Lou.
Going on?
It is working for me.
Going on.
Yeah.
Good to be here, Lou.
Yep. Good touch, good touch. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So what in the world is going on?
What, the wide world of sports? This is Michael Dean. Let's chime in. Randy. Go ahead, Randy England.
What is this, a sound check? One, two, three, four?
No, it's a get to know the Fiends. And that was Lou Sander Fiend talking. And then we got Diana Davison. Hi, Diana.
Hey.
Also known as the new Diana. Speak up like you're on radio, Missy.
I got the new Fiend phone going on, so you can't blame me.
The new Fiend bone going on here. And there's great news in the world of Fiendness is that the satellite that we're on in Africa is back up and running throughout Central Africa. Diana, do you know about that? Do you know about that we are on a satellite in Africa?
No idea.
Yeah,
this is very, very good news.
It is very cool. It was Ian Freeman, who runs Free Talk Live, and LRN, the other network around besides GCN, raised a bunch of thousands of dollars to pay for a couple years of Ku-band satellite, which is this weird, like, free-to-air satellite that a lot of people use in kind of third-worldy places where they don't have internet or even, like, regular electricity. They buy these cheap satellite receivers, and they have listening parties. Like, we know people who are Fiends fans who, you know, once every 3 months they go into the next town, like the nearest town that has internet they can rent for an hour, and they write us emails and tell us that they have listening parties where they get together and have, like, 15 or 20 people sitting around listening to Freedom Fiends and Free Talk Live and the other LRN shows. How cool is that?
That is excellent.
They should be downloading that whole time. But so you're saying that we are live in Africa right now, right?
Yeah.
Now what
is live?
Unheavenly hour is it in Africa right now? I wonder.
It's tomorrow, probably dinner time in most of Africa. In the middle of
Africa is pretty big, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like 3 days later over there.
It's 3 days later there.
It's really big, yes.
Yep. So the other good news is, and this is more about spreading the Freedom Fiends and the Free Talk Lives and the Liberty Radio Network, there are now two new really good free apps for LRN.FM. One's on the Google Play Store, and one is on the iTunes Store. And I will link them. And I've decided that people need to download. First of all, you need to download them because it actually, like, the first 30 days of an app on these app stores seems to, like, determine where it gets recommended and stuff. So go download it even if you're not going to use it, but especially if you're going to use it because it's very useful to have, and it basically allows you to have LRN.FM 24/7 streaming into your chromed robot turd in your pocket. But the other
is
thing
it named,
is,
named LRN? Is that it? Because I'm going there right now.
There's a few different apps called that. One is the LRN. It's the iTunes one is LRN.FM by Abby Gonzalez. And the Google Play one is LRN.FM by Audio Now Digital. And I will link them both in tonight's show notes. But I think
that's the number
one. You need to download them or you're going to set Liberty back 3,500 years. It's kind of a social contract. I've decided what you need on your chromed robot turret.
Well, thank you for making that decision, Michael.
I know. I need
it's
to make
good
it for
to know
people
somebody
that can't
is
make
in
it
control.
Themselves.
We're installing my Android as we speak here.
Oh, good. Good.
I'll be getting an echo in the room in just a moment, I think.
You'll be getting a 30-second echo because it's pretty
Oh,
long.
That bad?
Well, because it's no, there's a delay. Streaming involves buffering for like 15 to 30 seconds. That's okay. How it works. Although, you know, really, they could use Fiend Phone as a delivery mechanism. It would not buffer. It would buffer a quarter second. It'd be almost like live. And I think someone could use Fiend Phone at least as like to replace satellite delivery to radio show to the radio station. But you know, social contract, man. prove me wrong. You signed a social contract, Lou, didn't you?
No, I'm pretty sure I didn't. But
it's
Diana
a requirement. It's a requirement when you're coming out of the birth canal.
Diana did. Go ahead, Diana.
Now, what did I throw out there? It's like, it's nice to know somebody's in control. I think that's one of the things that we're facing in society is there's so many people who want somebody else to be in control. And so they're willing to give up their autonomy in order to get that sense of safety, right? So the social contract is elementally, I think at its core, you're talking about, do you belong to yourself or do you belong to society? And the idea of the social contract is that as a part of society, that your life should be spent bettering society, and your personal life comes secondary because you're not actually. I mean, it's collectivism versus individualism, right?
Oh, definitely.
But the social contract, though, you know, you said that you should be, you know, doing all these things for your, you know, your fellow man or whatever. And of course, it's more than that. It's not that you should be. It's that you must be, or we're going to hurt you. Isn't that the bottom line?
Well, yeah, that's what we have our cops and our prisons for, right?
Oh, sure, sure. But the should versus must, I think, is pretty important because
well, you have to think, you know, like them to understand what you're up against, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately,
excuse me for a second. Excuse me. Our cops in our prisons.
That's the collectivist mindset. They're there for you because you aren't you. You are part of the collective.
Lou thought you had a mouse in your pocket or something there, you know.
Yeah.
We're just like, the Borg.
We wrote the social contract. Ugh. So where do you think this idea of the social contract comes from? You've mentioned collectivist thought. You mentioned that folks want somebody to be in charge. How much do you think of that is human nature versus human conditioning?
I think it's utopian thinking. And utopian thinking is so dangerous. There's a heroic drive in human nature, and I'm going to say this is human nature, that we want to, you know, defy death somehow. We want to, you know, overcome our mortality. And so one of the positive things, in a way, is the heroic side of people in their attempt to make their life meaningful. But the downside is that they get into this utopian thinking where it's based on the idea that you can control the, you know, life and the world around you, and that's ultimately how it manifests, is in control.
Okay. Do you think that the utopian thinking is conditioned or human nature, though?
I think it's fear-based.
Okay. Well, elaborate on that a little bit, please.
Well, it's, you know, fear-based is just a primal instinct. So are we talking about, is this like innate versus learned? Is that the question?
Yeah.
I come in more on the side of learned behavior. I think there's some innate aspects to the human animal because we are animals. But I think that when we talk about behavior, that the manifestations of the behavior, the things that concern us, those are learned behaviors. We're a symbolic animal. And as much as we like to study the brain, they don't know exactly how it works. And it's the symbolism that creates culture, that creates all these really fabulous, interesting ideas and conversations that go on. And but there's the fear-based behavior behind what we think we're doing. That's the part that's innate, that's instinctual. And it causes us to do, you know, things that we otherwise wouldn't if we were in a rational state of mind.
Okay. I will agree with you that it's learned, but I'm going to go beyond learned and use conditioned. I think that with the state indoctrination camps or government indoctrination gulags, whatever you want to call them, I think that when a parent drops their kid off there, well, first of all, kids are perceptive. So they figure, well, if mommy and daddy are dropping me off here, then obviously these people know more than mommy and daddy. So they go in and they start pledging allegiance to the flag and singing all these songs and everything else. And by the way, if Walmart ran the schools and the kids started off the day by pledging allegiance to Walmart and singing songs about Walmart, and there were pictures of the CEOs and founders of Walmart all over the place, would that be just a little bit creepy?
I think I saw a bill that they want to start doing that, actually.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a little bit creepy? But nobody has a problem when government does it. But anyway, you have this indoctrination, and that's when you start hearing all these things about, well, without government, everybody would be killing each other and everything else. So we have this wonderful social contract that says that you must do this, this, and this, otherwise society will fall apart. And because children are young and impressionable, and they always get them young, you know, I think you start regular school, kindergarten around five, something like that. I don't know. I don't have kids. But anyway, they get these kids in there and they start talking, you know, about all this stuff. And they're at a point where they're just absorbing things like a sponge. And it just goes right in. And plus, you know, with the whole idea of authority figures, meaning the teacher, because for a child, most of their whole social structure is built around that school. And as a matter of fact, the school is an attempt to replace family. But they start getting bombarded with all this propaganda and all this state worship. So they become conditioned to believe in the state and to love it like it was their mother. Right, take the Pledge of Allegiance, for example. How many kindergarten students do you know that can define allegiance or can explain what a republic is?
I think it's really interesting with kids that they tend to respond well to structure, something that gives them a sense of understanding power. There was a really great quote. I'm not sure exactly who to attribute it to, but they said, you've got one chance to get power right, learning about power. And if you get that wrong, you don't get a chance to get anything else right. I know I really messed up that quote. But in the growth of a child, one of the important things is understanding, like, cause, you know, they spend their whole life getting in trouble or getting rewarded. And that's really just about learning about power, which is a really important aspect of, you know, statehood and social contracts and deciding who to invest your power in and how to fit into that power structure yourself, right? But as much as they respond well to structure, there's also that part of the kid that's just, I think, slowly dying as their imagination is being cut off, saying, well, it's really cute that you did that, but don't do it again. And they slowly have all of that cut out of their life.
More Freedom Fiends coming up after this trip to the market, and your children will not have their dreams and imaginations crushed if you listen to this show. Worms.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
The Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition is proud to present the 3rd Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. It will be held at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan from August 7th through the 10th. There will be vending, discussions, presentations, all sorts of activities for children and adults, and bacon, lots of bacon. Round up your friends and family and get them registered today at miplc.org. That's miplc.org. Dogs welcome. Longer leashes recommended. Meow.
Meow, 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 meow. This is the Freedom Fiends. Oh, yeah. I got a cat hooting and hollering outside the house. It's a couple doors down. I don't know what's up with it. It was, like, outside my window the other day. I don't know if it's, like, getting gobbled up by the fox that's been running around or just wants inside. I don't know, but it's making a racket out there. So I was inspired to meow. But anyway, yeah, back to the social contract.
Yeah, well, we were, you know, talking about the, you know, indoctrination of children and so on, right? And the social contract, most people, that you just born into it. And so you're in this contract, but you didn't sign anything, you didn't agree to it. Now, we've got, like, this really interesting situation going on in Greece, where their faith in their society has got every reason to crumble, right? I think it's an awesome place to imagine anarchy testing itself out. And, you know, there's some article saying that they're going to start auctioning off on eBay some islands, right?
I don't know if it's going to be on eBay, but they're going to have to liquidate their assets.
I think that's kind of like Onion reporting, right? It's like reading it on the Onion.
You know, it's true. It's Zero Hedge. Is ZeroHedge.com. So
wouldn't
anyway,
that be fun to see a bunch of people in Greece just, like, take over one of the islands that's, you know, out of state control and give her a go?
Well, no. The islands would be sold to somebody that had the money, and the money would be given to whoever was holding the Greek debt, right? I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
As a fundraiser. And the thing that I find kind of interesting about, you know, the Greek situation is that it's been going on for several years. And back at the beginning, the debt was being held by European hands, banks, investors, whatever, that were holding the Greek debt. And they kept holding Greece up long enough, you know, and getting them deeper in the hole, and somehow managed to transfer most of that debt from private hands into public hands, into the German and the French governments mainly. I think Germany's got the big piece, don't they?
I think they're on the hook for the most.
Yeah. But it's the governments now that are on the hook. And the guys who got into this thing to begin with apparently got out of it, and now they don't have to worry. But the governments don't want to be on the hook for the Greek debt. So apparently, it seems to me that they probably need to string the Greeks along until they have bled, you know, the last drop out of them. And as long as any Greek property is still in Greek hands, I don't think they've bled them completely. So they just need to keep going until there's nothing left. And then after they own everything, then they go, well, we don't care what you do. You know, we know you're going to default, but there's nothing left. So, you know,
there's very little fertile land that's available for purchase, right? So all we need to do is find an anarchist who's got like 4 billion euros, right? That can't be that hard.
Or 40 billion would be more like it, or 100 billion. It would take a lot. And, you know, of course, it's fertile land. You know, the biggest part of the government land in the United States, of course, is not so fertile, right? The big stretches in the desert and all of that. Good places for testing nuclear weapons, I suppose, but maybe not much else.
I think the social contract is really just like a big marketing scheme, right? So what are they selling you? They sell you, in America, they got the American dream. What is the American dream?
We give them tax money and they give us laws.
Well, it depends on which version of the American dream that the politicians and statocrats and everything else are selling at the time. If you remember back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the American dream was homeownership, or at least that's what we were told. And then in 2008, boom, we found out that the American dream was actually a nightmare. But I'm looking at this article here on Greece, what you're talking about with putting islands on eBay. It's got a picture of Homer sitting on the panel of the local TV news, and the crawl says, Europe puts Greece on eBay. And the caption is, you know, Simpsons had it right all along. Looking at America's debt problems, or let me rephrase, the American government's debt problems, because just like the social contract, I never signed those loan papers. I was talking to somebody, about 3 weeks, a month ago, something like that, and I just straight up asked him, I says, you know, how does America pay off $18 trillion in debt, or $18 plus trillion dollars in acknowledged debt? Doesn't include the unfunded liabilities and everything else. You know, how does that happen? And he says, well, I don't know. I says, well, why not just default and repudiate it? And his response was, but that would mean that democracy has failed. And of course, I said, it has failed.
Well, it's that fear of the structures, the known, falling apart. We have a debt clock in Vancouver, downtown Gastown.
Hey, we're out.
With Michael Dean and his weird friends.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Oh, yeah. Freedom Fiends. Hey, this is Lou, and I've got Randy England and
Diana
Davison. So, yeah, more on social contract and Greece burning. And, yes, Greece is burning right now. Well, not really burning, but they are lobbing tear gas, and the cops are lobbing tear gas at the protesters. Protesters are lobbing Molotov cocktails. And, yeah, so...
I find it interesting, like, that is the public perception of anarchy, right? When people think of anarchy, they think of the Sex Pistols and Molotov cocktails and people in trench coats with, you know, crazy beards and stuff like that. And from my reading, anarchists are not so much in favor of revolution, because you just overthrow one bad system with another bad system. It's, you know, like, too emotional a time frame to put something reasonable and logical in place. They're more in favor of an evolutionary, you know, transition into an anarchist system.
Yeah. You're right. You know, that's true. There were anarchists back, you know, at the turn of the century, before the end of the 1800s, and that, who were into what they called the, you know, the propaganda of the deed, that actually were into violence and that. But I think that was very overrated, in that they were never so many of those people that were like that, nor were they nearly as violent as the government wanted people. People wanted them to. The government wanted us to be very afraid, just like they want us to be very afraid now. So there were never so many of those violent anarchists as they wanted us to believe, but somehow it stuck. The propaganda stuck, and like you said, Diana, the people have this idea that there's violence, and yet the anarchists that I know are the most peaceful people, and they're just this side of being pacifists. They wouldn't hurt a fly, at least as long as the fly wasn't attacking them. So
it's kind of like the one bad apple theory, right? And that actually, like, I don't think that's an official theory. That's what I call it. It's part of, you know, the motivation behind, you know, the people who want structure of some sort, that, you know, they'll reject anarchy because they believe the one bad apple means that there's tons of bad apples, and without the state to protect you from those bad apples, then it's just going to be chaos and riots and Molotov cocktails.
Yeah, it's bird flu anarchism, because for every, like, 1 million times that bird flu or bomb throwing is mentioned, there's actually one actual occurrence.
Yeah, well, I think another problem is apathy, right? So, like, we were talking during the break about the debt clock that I mentioned. We have one down in the Gastown SkyTrain station in Vancouver, and it's counting off the debt. It's just, like, digital numbers on a screen that everybody can see. It's really large, and so many people go through there every day watching the debt increase without cessation. And instead of having the effect of informing people, it creates an apathy. We're just like, oh, yeah, it's the debt clock, you know?
Yeah, and there's nothing shocking about it because they see it every day.
And it's funny because they complain about apathy in, you know, democracy and the voting polls and stuff. Not enough people going out to vote. And they're trying to increase people's, you know, attention to it. And actually, any issue that you take up with the public, they have become obviously apathetic. They're just like, oh, I don't, you know. You have to make it fun for them to listen to things because they're just, you know, overwhelmed. There's too much. Like, I don't even know what to think. I don't know.
Go ahead, Lou.
If voting in democracy is the solution to the problem, how did the problem happen in the first place? Was it not through voting in democracy?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't vote because I don't want to encourage them.
Right. I always hear these people say, we got to throw those bums out. And then their solution is to put new bums in. And they never think of how the bums got in there in the first place. But it's that whole idea of, well, democracy can't fail. And going back to my story at the end of the last segment was, how does $18 trillion plus dollars of current acknowledged debt, not to include the unfunded liabilities, get paid off? I'm not sure what current GDP numbers are, but, you know, I think that the U.S. national debt has surpassed actual GDP. I think it's like 105%.
Oh, so. it's more than that. It's well above that now. You know, the funny thing is, I'm sure that there would be a lot of hardship that would come if, say, the U.S. government just repudiated all its debt and said we're defaulting, or if Greece did the same thing. And I'm not an economist in that, but what do you think people's attitude would be about loaning money to governments if governments started just repudiating their debt? I mean,
well, they would quit doing it.
Well, that would be wonderful. That would be like tomorrow, and not that I'm hoping for a place where the state actually becomes healthy, because they would still persecute people. But actually, it would be an improvement if every government, just like every home, every person, didn't spend any more money than they had to spend. And there was no more deficit spending, and there couldn't be, because nobody in their right mind would loan them any money. That would be kind of great.
Oh, that would be all sorts of different awesome, with sprinkles even.
Yeah, now, I guess they could print money, but then if you could get the government out of the money business too, like having bitcoins or gold and silver or something like that, then they wouldn't be able to manipulate the money supply aside from borrowing, and the whole thing would just be honest. That could never happen.
Well, that's the whole point to legal tender laws, is to keep people from using healthy alternatives. Because everybody knows that if your money is no darn good, then you need to make a law requiring people to use it.
Well, I thought the only legal tender in the United States was gold and silver.
That's if you believe in magic parchment theory, another social contract.
Yeah, at least that one's written down on a piece of paper. You know, one thing, the social contract, and I think you said you actually own Rousseau's On the Social Contract, the book where the popularization of the term came from. Although, wasn't he French? It was in French.
Yes.
I don't know what the French word was for the social contract. But it was funny, back when he wrote that, when was that? The middle 1700s or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
I think that Rousseau did say some things like, if you don't like the contract, you could just go somewhere else. And maybe in the middle 1700s, he had a point. But
yeah,
I don't know
where. Not
so
easy to leave nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't easy then. Now it's become impossible. The reason it's impossible.
Especially if you're trying to carry fruit. You can't cross the border with fruit.
Crossing the border lately, have you? They were very interested in whether I had fruit when I went from Porkfest, and one day I crossed over into Canada to visit a park up there that was pretty neat, and they were really interested in whether I had fruit and eggs. And then the guy said, and do you have more than $10,000? And I just laughed. I said, I wish. And he said, well, just you guys have a nice day. And we went on in. So it was great. All the trouble came when I tried to get back into the country. Now, that was nasty.
Now, it's interesting that you brought up the whole if you don't like it, leave thing. I have an article here. It's from Libertarian Money. That's a WordPress site. And it talks about seven reasons why you're not free to leave. Now, of course, everybody, if you criticize the government, or if you point out what is actually happening, rather than people saying, you know what, you're right, we need to fix this, they'll say something stupid. Well, if you don't like it, move to Somalia where you don't have any government. But they never volunteer to move to North Korea where they have just the right amount of state that they're looking for. Matter of fact, North Korea, although it is a leftist paradise, it's also a conservative paradise, too. No Mexicans, no Muslims, lots of border security, and lots of military. Conservatives should be flocking to go over there, seriously.
Yeah, but anyway, you have a good point.
But going back to the points made in this article, you're still extorted if you leave. There are two countries in the world that still require people to pay taxes when they're living and working outside of that country. One is some dinky little country in Africa, Eritrea is what it's called, and they only have a 2%.
They're going to be so mad at you right now. Dinky.
Why?
Little country.
Well, the article,
they're in Africa, so they can hear us too. So
yeah. Luke, I know they're listening right now.
They're down on you right now. They're probably riding to Michael, Well, actually, can we give out his email address? Contact him at the Fiends Facebook page.
Yeah, there's a 30-second delay, so they're just now hearing it. But anyway,
okay.
So anyway, they have a 2% citizenship tax. So to be a piece of tax cattle on that particular tax farm, you have to pay 2%, which really isn't that bad because compared to the U.S., you know, you still
pay 10 times that tax. Or more.
Yeah, easily. So even if you do leave, you're still extorted. You're forced to participate to leave. You're free to leave, okay, all right, but you know, you still have to go through all the paperwork that goes with it, and it's just really nonsense. And you also have to, you know, cash out your chips and leave like 30% with the house.
Don't you have to pay everything you owe to? I mean, if you were a person who hadn't been paying your federal income tax, you're not getting out until that's all paid, right?
Right. And
getting a visa and a passport isn't all that easy. I actually can't get a passport right now because I have no friends. I have nobody who can sign for me. Isn't that sad? I'm going to have to wait till you guys know me for 2 years so I can find somebody to sign my passport form.
But what, we're not Canadian, would that matter?
Oh, that's right.
Do you really tell want them Fiends as references?
Still can't get it.
It's not a lot of help. You could tell them that you're on YouTube a lot.
Yeah, I don't think they care about that. But no, even just to get a passport, you have to have lived in a place. So I just moved back to Vancouver again recently, so I haven't been here for 2 years. I don't have, like, you know, a dentist I've known for 2 years, you know, like, things like that. But it's really not that easy to, like, you know, getting the passport is really, I guess it's not really that hard, but getting visas, you know, and there's, you know, you have to have proof of travel to get visas before you can even apply for them sometimes. And then once you get there, like, I went to England for a year, and I was staying with a friend who owned property over there. And they actually stopped me, and they physically phoned the guy to make sure that I actually knew somebody there. And I had a family visa, one where I could work while I lived there. I'm blanking on what it's called, but like my grandmother was from England, so that was like a big hassle just to get there for a year.
Now, where do you need a visa to go there?
Well, I needed one to go to England.
You need one to go to England. Would I need one to go to England? I visited Canada. I didn't need one to go there.
No, we got more open borders here.
Okay, but
unusually open borders.
But you couldn't see. I've never been to England, so I don't even know what I would need. I have a passport, but that's it. You know,
no, I had a visa, and they still stopped me and checked everything out.
Well, yeah, but.
And we will be back, and we won't check your papers.
With Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Lou, and we got Randy and Diana, and before we went off to the break, we were talking about why you can't really leave when somebody tells you move to Somalia. That's not really an option. Something else, you can still be forced to go to war. You can still be drafted for like up to 10 years after you've renounced your citizenship. And you can still be drafted, you know, hey, you have to go fight and steal that oil.
Yeah. You know, last summer or last spring, I was out and went on some kind of a tour out in Arizona. And a tour guide, he was an older guy there, and he was talking about how he had come to the United States when he was maybe I don't know, 13 or 14 or something, and from New Zealand maybe, and he left the United States when he was just before he was draft age, maybe 17 years old or 18, and moved to some other foreign country where several years later he got a draft notice. And, you know, I was sitting there listening to that, and I want to go, yeah, and don't tell me now that you're a Vietnam veteran. And he goes, yeah, that's it. I came back and went over there. And I couldn't believe it. I was just stunned that someone would come from overseas to come and fight in an American war. How is that possible? And he wasn't even an American.
And to top it off, it would have been shorter just to fly to Vietnam.
I'm not sure if that's to
make the trip back.
Well, closer to New Zealand. I don't remember where he was, but I had never heard of such a thing that they would chase you to the ends of the earth to drag you and draft you into the army.
Well, war is one of the few things that government really, really, really takes seriously, because war is the health of the state.
Absolutely.
It seems to me like the mentality of somebody living in another country who gets a draft notice and says, oh, well, then I must go back. Like, it's that, to me, that's the biggest problem. It's the mentality of the people who buy into it, who go along with it, because they just think, well, then I must. Right?
Now, during Desert Storm, I was stationed in Germany, and I knew a number of expats. And When you sign up for the military, there's a total 8-year commitment. And if you do 8 years of active duty, then there's no commitment after that. But like, let's say you do 4 years, there's a 4-year inactive ready reserve portion of it, to where they can call you back and say, all right, you have to fight. But anyway, a lot of the expats that were over there, they'd only been out for, you know, a year or two or something like that. And because they weren't living in the continental United States, they really didn't have to worry about it, because one of the guys actually checked on it
and found out that they're not going to come after you, and they're not going to go to the government in whose country you're in and demand that you be brought back or something. Is that right?
Pretty much. Or if they were going to do that, they probably would have sent MPs from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, or Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, to go over there, when they could have just called like the MPs in Ansbach and said, yeah, pick this guy up. But anyway.
Well, so much of, you know, getting compliance from the government, it's not that they could actually force most people to do all the things they want them to do, as long as people think that they will. I mean, I can remember when I was a prosecutor, I used to, we would subpoena people to come and testify. They would send jury notices to people who were supposed to come and do jury duty. Never in my life did I ever try to take some judicial action against somebody who didn't want to come and testify in a case. Now, and normally you can have them dragged in there by the sheriff and have them thrown in jail if they don't want to testify on contempt charges, and the judge will do it. Of course, I think I kind of had a practical reason for that. I thought anybody that didn't want to come and be my witness bad enough might not turn out to be that good a witness. You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, you know, you have these nightmares about how you're going to get stabbed in the back if you try to force somebody to do something they don't want. So if I didn't have a willing witness, then I didn't have a case. And that was the end of that. And
so you inject common sense?
Well, you better inject common sense. You know, it's kind of like, you know, issues of jury nullification is where the people come and say, we don't like this. Well, the prosecutor better figure out quickly what the people like or don't like, or they'll be standing for not being reelected pretty quickly. Hey, I think we're going to the market, aren't we?
Yep. Jury nullification, where the common people can pretend that they are the masters of government and not the other way around. More Freedom Fiends coming up after this news break. Wines.
No, for a brief shining moment, they are the masters.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Oh. Hello, and this is the Freedom Fiends.
Bean phone.
We're back Bean in phone. The second hour right now, and the Freedom Fiends is a symposium of unsupervised sounds that tickle the weekend and weeknight fiend bone of liberty. I'm Randy England. I've got co-hosts here, Diana, and I think Lou is also with us. Lou, are you here?
I just got back. Yes.
Lou just got back. He was away for a bit. We sent him to hack into the CIA's subspace mind control to beam our pirate signal of protest directly to your frontal lobe, so you won't have to worry about the satellite. So just lose your tinfoil hats. Know that you're free. And hi, Diana. I didn't hear your voice. I hope you're still here with us.
Oh, I'm here.
And I know that Lou is here. And also, I think that we should also mention, since this is a fresh hour, that the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license, which allows reuse by anyone except governments. So learn more about the BIPCOT license at BIPCOT.org. And Lou, I'm not sure... we got through the list of seven reasons why you're not free to leave, but I think that we may have reached a point there. The point number three was trading slave masters, and I noticed the interesting thing. The lead-in on that was the writer pointed out that to tell someone, an anarchist or a narco-capitalist or whatever, that they're free to leave America is like telling them that they can pick whichever rapist they choose. the choices are not good. And unlike back when Rousseau wrote The Social Contract and thought that maybe you had somewhere to go, there is nowhere to go anymore. The problem is it doesn't matter if I really can't get away with it. I think Diana could probably testify that I really couldn't get much relief if I crossed the border to Canada. And some things would be different. Maybe some more things would be different in Mexico. But I don't know of any place I could actually go to get shed of this state that's dogging me every time I turn around.
Well, I hear there's a really good island in Greece for sale.
Lots of them.
I don't have enough money to buy it, though.
Well, that's the thing. It's like this walk away, idea. It's ridiculous. You can't actually, you can move from town to town in most places. You can switch your city, but you're not switching, your government. It's all the same. And as has been said over and over again, part of this apathy discussion is going on. Even for those who believe that voting is going to make a difference in their world, it doesn't matter. You're still voting for the same thing. It's just a slightly left or slightly right version of the same thing.
And the difference is
one party.
Yeah, the differences are slight. My brother-in-law is visiting me right now, and he's from Oregon. And in Oregon is one of those very few states in the union where it's against the law to pump your own gas. And, I guess I'm kind of glad that I don't have that. I suppose I have that choice. Every once in a while, we'll see a gas station that offers to pump my gas if I pay extra money. And I'd rather have the choice than have the government tell me that I was too stupid to know how to pump my own gas. But the differences from one state to another just aren't enough to make a difference. And so why bother?
So how does a law like that get passed, though? Like, did somebody pump their own gas and then, like, set themselves on fire, and so a law was passed to prevent people from pumping their own gas? Is that
probably not? If something is really dangerous and they passed a law to alleviate the danger, I'm not saying I would agree with it, but I guess I could understand it a little bit better. But most laws like that are never passed because somebody's trying to help somebody or someone has complained about a problem. Usually it's somebody who comes in that's got something to gain by it, like gas station owners, like
the lobby groups.
Yeah, the lobby groups. They're the ones that call the shots. You know, the purpose of occupational licensing. I'm an attorney, and I have to, you know, jump through, you know, all kinds of hoops and kiss people's behinds, you know, every year paying dues and doing whatever I'm told to do. And there, I don't know that there has ever been any licensing scheme. And almost a third of the jobs in this country require a government permission, a government slip to do the job. You have to have their license, their permission. And every one of those that has been created that I'm aware of was not created at the behest of someone complaining about how the doctors, the lawyers, the hairdressers are done something bad to them, and they need to be regulated for the safety and benefit of the public. Without exception, the leaders of the profession that would like to be licensed, you know, and substitute the word granted a government monopoly so that it becomes a crime for anyone to practice that profession unless they get permission from those people who are already in the profession. The only purpose of that is to control the number of people that are allowed to practice the profession and to raise the rates. And, of course, it makes the availability of the service is way low. I mean, if you didn't have licensing, it would probably be much cheaper to get a will, get a divorce, get, I don't know, just about anything. There are so many things that in my profession that do not require all of my great learning, you know, from law school. They're just routine, stupid things, you know?
One of the things that drives me nuts is that you can't go out on the street and just sell things that you've made, or like you can't just start up a business. How do they expect, like, it's outrageous. I can't fathom how it got to a state like that where you can't even come up with, you know, an idea to provide for yourself and then just do it. That it costs you money, which a lot of the people in that situation where they have to self-employ don't have any money, and they're being prevented from doing that. And what society would rather just give them welfare instead of letting them go out on the street and sell wares?
Well, licensing, it just like the requirement that there be a gas station attendant, is protectionism. And it's not just protectionism for the people that work in the industry, because when you look at the gas station attendant in Oregon, you can't pump your own gas. You know, a lot of times the statocrats are saying, well, what sort of job would this person have if we didn't require them to have a job? And when you start looking at the licensing, what it becomes is, one, the statocrats probably think that they are providing a service, and they probably think that they're legitimate and that they can centrally plan a perfect economy. But what the licensing bureaus become are self-sustaining shakedown operations with the only purpose of sustaining themselves. Because when you have licensing, you need to have people. So that creates jobs for more statocrats. And as, you know, the costs rise and you have these generous, you know, public sector pensions and all this other stuff, you need more licensing to help fund that, and the program grows and grows and grows and grows, and next thing you know, you need a license to do everything. You know, not just cut hair or do nails or things like that. You need a license just to open up a business in the first place. So ultimately, what the economy turns into is a life support system for the state.
It really does, but I think that the occupational licensing is just largely crony capitalism. It's just corruption. It's mercantilism, where the government is granting monopoly licenses so that people can rake in money far beyond what their actual skills and you know, excellence of whatever they do merit. And if just flung open the doors, things would be so much better.
I'm not going to disagree with that, but I'm also going to provide an alternate theory. And it goes back to the omnipotent busybodies that think that they can control things. A lot of times, if you have entrepreneurs that say, okay, well, the government's going to get involved and screw everything's up. So how about if we go along with it and try and get things set up, you know, screwed up in the way that we would like them to be screwed up versus just having that, having government go in and screw it up on their own?
I think you're giving them too much credit. It's great. The government always gains from having a new profession licensed under a government monopoly, because they, although they're not usually controlling that, that monopoly, they leave that to the people involved. Even like with the lawyers, in most places, it's the however many lawyers, 7 or 9 lawyers that sit on the state Supreme Court that rule the roost. And every one of them are lawyers. They're just the top lawyers in the profession, and they run it. But what the government knows for a fact is that those lawyers are all, they're all in the government's camp. They love their monopoly. They love their monopoly, and that's a whole thing of support. And when you make 30% of the people be licensed, then that's 30% of the people that have a monopoly granted to them by the government. Pretty soon, you know, you're owning a lot of the citizenry there. And that can't be bad for the government, even though it may not directly give them money. It certainly brings them power, and that's probably more important than money.
I've never worked for the government or been involved with them in a way like that, but I was part of a film union, and I imagine most unions work like this. And I was actually on the executive for the union, and after about a year, that was all I needed to know about the government. It to me, functions the same way, where the union comes into existence, and then its primary goal is to continue to exist. It's supposed to be there to protect and to serve the members of the union, but it's actually functioning only to keep its own life there. And they will throw anyone under the bus in, you know, when it comes to, and the people who were elected to run it were people who generally weren't working, right? They weren't all that good at their trade.
Well, yeah, the ones who are running it, the bosses, they don't do anything except they're just parasites that, you know, suck off of what the earnings of the real workers are making.
You get elected, right? Which is what, charisma, right? So there was something, you know, they made a good
speech. They're politicians is what they are. They're politicians.
The social contract says that people can't be left to their own devices. So a certain group of people has to go and run everything and make the rules and keep those people from, you know, doing people stuff.
People stuff.
Yep. More Freedom Fiends when we come back on this trip to the market.
Doing people stuff.
Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Hey, this is Squiskar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now. So there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
2 designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
3 designs for Fiend Phone.
Bipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1 1/4 inch, and now they're 1 3/4 inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Oh, yeah. Freedom Fiends. Hey, this is Lou, and I'm joined by Randy and Diana.
Hi, Lou.
Worms.
Yeah, we're worms. Here. We're worms. Ready. We're ready.
So anyway, Diana, you have some social justice stuff to talk about and how it is a threat.
Well, yeah, like I think my perception is that, anarchism and libertarianism, for those who aren't quite ready for the full-fledged thing, it's growing in popularity lately. People are starting to imagine new ways of living. But at the same time, the state is growing with social justice warriors, right? So there's, I was studying this professor at the University of Ottawa. She's a professor of law, but she's also got a new title, Professor of Social Justice. And I find it really stunning that law and social justice are two different things, right? And because people, they use justice in the name to invoke this idea that they're doing something good, right, for everybody.
I'm going to interrupt for just a second. Law and just plain old justice are two different things. As former Supreme Court judge, Oliver Wendell Holmes said, he has a famous quote, "This isn't a court of law, son. This isn't a court of justice, son. It's a court of law."
Never forget it.
Well, law can come down to words and stuff like that.
That's all law is.
That's one of the big complaints, is it's really about who can use the words better. But I think the profession of law is quite noble. I actually think that there's some really great concepts behind, legal theory and the way they reason their decisions and so on. And in fact, there was one specific law, whether or not a husband could rape his wife, right? And the feminists have campaigned heavily to make sure that it can be deemed rape. One country was lagging. I can't remember. It was a Norwegian country. Hadn't changed their law. But you know what? They were the first country to convict a man of raping his wife. So the practice of law isn't really just about words. This country, who, according to the feminists, were way behind the times, was actually the very first one to convict a man of doing this thing they're being accused of not recognizing as a crime. So I do think you can, the concept of justice is included in the law, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, now feminists never let reality get in the way of their argument. But here's what you have to remember about the law: it is always subject to the interpretation of the interpreters. If the law meant something, if the law was more than the words of Nancy Pelosi, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush, then you wouldn't have 5-4 split decisions in the Supreme Court. As a matter of fact, you wouldn't even need a Supreme Court, because it would be easily interpreted and implemented down at the local district court level. What the law is, it's a declaration of men. So there is no rule of law. It's a rule of man. It's a rule of rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Well, it would still be that. And most of the law, even in a stateless society, would still stand. I mean, when you have the procedure about what happens, there's the Uniform Commercial Code, and I don't know if any other countries adopt it, but most of the countries in the U.S., states in the U.S., have adopted the Uniform Commercial Code. And it just says, here's what happens, here's what a check is, here's what it means, here's who's responsible for this. I mean, that sort of thing would totally exist if you had no government at all. If the government disappeared tomorrow, somebody would be out there saying, we need to get some regularity, because people are not going to simply sit down and write whole contracts every time they want to do business. They're going to write out a contract that says has a few basic terms, and then they're going to say the rest of this contract will be governed by the Uniform Commercial Code. And they will do that because, number one, it's easy, and number two, it's fair. It's justice. It really is justice, because they worked out something. Merchants tend to gravitate to fair rules, because they know one day they may be a buyer, but the next day their ox is going to be gored from the other side. They may be a seller. And so the rules for buyers and sellers tend to even out and be very, very fair. and you add the fairness to uniformity, and you can't get any better than that. And rules of evidence in court, those would stay about the same.
It hasn't with social justice, though. I think that they're misrepresenting the term, because social justice, that's the other side of it, goal. Yes. Their primary goal is to change what equality means to mean substantive equality, which means that you can't have people approach the court as equals because some people are oppressed, and so they must be treated differently in the court of law. That's what substantive equality is doing, that you're giving absolutely a handicap not to one person. That's what social justice is, and that's why people are, like, they're increasing the requirements in society legally that you must hire people if they say that you discriminated against them based on some one of the human
and
rights.
And we'll be right back things. After this trip to the market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
For some reason in this country, and in a bunch of lesser world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created FiendPhone. I'm using FiendPhone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to FiendPhone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's FiendPhone.com, FiendPhone.com, Foxtrot, Echo, November, Phone.com.
FiendPhone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
Joined by Randy and Diana, and before we were so rudely interrupted, you were talking about discrimination and employment and everything else.
Stop. I get really worked up about this social justice thing.
Continue.
At the same time that people are getting so creative and imagining new ways of living, and I actually think, like, I consider Freedom Fiends living anarchy. It's an example of how to do anarchy right now. Bring it into your life in whatever ways are possible. But at the same time, we have this opening up. The social justice professors and advocates, mostly you'll find them on the internet, silencing free speech in the name of justice, right? So they claim that, they're sensitivity to your words, and they're so sensitive that university students have to be given trigger warnings on course material now. Things like Ovid, right? All of these classic literatures, they have to come with trigger warnings because we have somehow coddled society and made them so sensitive and so oppressed and so unable to live their lives freely that we must silence the freedom of other people to speak. And we must silence, authers of classic literature in order to make them feel safe.
I feel kind of dumb that I don't even know what Ovid's triggers would be, but...
Oh, there's descriptions of rape that happen.
Ah.
Because it was back in the time where these things were just part of war, and he wrote about it.
Well, I thought they were still part of war, but...
They are. You brought up an interesting point, Diana, about employment...
Yeah,
with the discrimination and employment. And before you go into that, I want to point out something. There once was a time when discrimination simply meant to choose. For example, a monogamous husband discriminates against all other women except for his wife for when it comes to his sexual relationships. It used to be considered a compliment to be of discriminating taste, but with the social justice warrior nonsense, also known as cultural Marxism, these words have been destroyed and they've been given new meanings that are of a negative connotation when there's no negativity involved. It's simply choosing.
Well, with the employment thing, One of the things that I found, and I've actually left jobs to go to another one where I made less money because I was working with people who I really enjoyed. And there's so much more to employment than just having a job or having the highest paying job. Who you work with is the primary component, and whether or not when you wake up in the morning, you're happy to go there. And I think that it's important for people to do jobs, even if it's a menial job. If you're working with people you enjoy, you can take some enjoyment from your life. You can take pride in what you do, right? And this idea of forcing somebody to hire you really just means that you want the right to go to work with people who you're going to hate because they don't like you.
And it's people ridiculous. Hate you. Yeah, yeah.
There's no common sense.
And that has to do with just about every kind of discrimination law in existence. So that if I discriminate against you, if I don't want to, say, feed you at my soda counter, you would want to force me to feed you. I think I've said before, I just can't imagine trying to force somebody to feed me. I mean, that'd be the last thing on earth that I would want someone, my enemy, to feed me. He'd feed me all right, you know, when I got done, and I'd be poisoned probably. But it's the same thing with the whole thing. I mean, we've got it in the same sex marriage thing, but you have the racial discrimination laws that do all those things, and they do nothing but hurt people. I don't see how they help anyone.
I like the comment about gay marriage. I think they have the right to be as miserable as everybody else.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up that little example, Randy. There's a meme that I saw on the internet, and it's Wednesday Addams from the Addams Family movies, and she's saying to the preppy, perky girl, she says, "I baked the cake that your lawyer forced me to bake. Go ahead, eat it. I dare
That's
you."
Exactly. Yeah, you know, I used to be in the restaurant business. I was in the restaurant business for a lot of years, and my very first job in the restaurant business was in a pizza parlor, and I was brand new, so I was the dishwasher, and then I was learning to make pizza, and there was a supervisor there that didn't like to make a certain sandwich, and he would always spit on the sandwiches because he hated the things. And he didn't even know the people, but he would just do that. It was so horrible. And, you know, I was horrified. I'd never seen such a thing as that in my life. And ever since then, it's been a great reality in my mind that there are people that do those things. And
it's like the movie The Help, too, where she goes and bakes a nice pie. And she wouldn't let the lady that she liked, the mother couldn't have any of the pie, and the mother figured it out, and it was not made of a very pleasant ingredient. Did you ever see the movie?
Yeah, I do remember that was pretty good.
It has to do with latrines.
yeah, you just don't want to do that. Oh, I did get my revenge though, because I stayed there long enough to become his boss, and at that moment I fired him. But before that, you know, I wasn't the kind of person. You know, I probably should have ratted him out, but I didn't. But I just waited and fired him, and that gave me the satisfaction that I'd had built up for about a year it took. But I mean, that's just a horrible thing, but it happens. And to invite that to happen, it seems to me unthinkable. But yet you see these court cases and that, and it's you know, I guess it's the same thing when people they sue to get their job back. Maybe all they want is just a bunch of money. And then when they're done, they have no desire for the job, whatever. Because who in their right mind wants to work for somebody who doesn't want them? I mean, it's just a scam.
This is one of the things that I'm looking at current society, is not just what is it that we're living under, but how are we contributing to it? Right. So how do we feed the system by actions?
I avoid it. I don't know if contributing to it. I avoid it. I'm a solo practitioner attorney. I have no employees. I could not discriminate against you if I tried, because I have no employees to discriminate against, and there's nothing they can do to me. I can have whatever opinions I want. There's nothing they can do to me. Absolutely nothing. And I like it that way. But it's not much, but at least... you know, anyone can try to work themselves into a situation like that where they, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, that's something that libertarians almost naturally do, is try to work themselves into situations where they're not quite as crossways with the state as they would be if they just kind of floated along without regard for it. Do you think?
Well, what has a tendency to happen is people get this idea of, well, we can either deal with this stupid thing or we can go with that stupid thing. It goes back to what I was talking about with regulation of industry. A lot of the business people will say, well, the government's going to get involved, so I may as well, you know, get them to do something less stupid than, you know, completely stupid. But you still wind up with stupidity, and because all this stuff has a tendency to compound, nobody takes the option of walk away. I believe it's Bastiat. He says there are three ways to order society. The many loot the few loot the many, or nobody loots anybody. And if you go with number three, you're considered a crazy person.
Yeah.
Seriously, the person that advocates not looting other people, the person that advocates minding their own business, gets labeled a crazy person. Now, and as an anarchist, you know, the true philosophy of anarchy is leave other people alone. And the statists hate the anarchists who would leave them alone more than they hate the opposite side of the statist spectrum of people who would bother them. I mean, seriously, how
we
much
all
sense
want
is this?
To be needed.
Yeah, the extremist thing, that reminds me of the, I think it was the Joseph Sobrin quote, who said, if you want government to intervene domestically, you're a liberal. And if you wanted government to intervene overseas, you're a conservative. If you want government to intervene everywhere, you're a moderate. But if you don't want government to intervene anywhere, you're an extremist. Are you familiar with Joseph Sobrin?
No.
Yeah, he was a political columnist for most of his life, I think, and he wrote an article, I think around 2003, he died 2 or 3 years ago, and where he came out, he was very conservative, kind of a paleo-conservative like Pat Buchanan, where he hated the wars. He always hated the wars for some reason, but he was very conservative in many other ways. But in around 2003, he just came out as a full-out anarchist and wrote a very famous famous essay called The Reluctant Anarchist. And he kind of told his tale, abbreviated a bit, about how he finally reached that point. And he said, you know, people always ask me, you know, what if we didn't have the government, you know, what would take its place? And then he went in, I'm sure, you know, you've all heard the statistics about how many people have been killed by governments over the last 100 years or so, and it's over 200 million people, not counting war dead. And
over a quarter billion. Think about that. A quarter billion.
Oh, my. Yeah. And there's no way all the great mass murderers of history, you know, that weren't aligned with governments, you know, the Ted Bundys and John Wayne Gacy's, all of those guys, they couldn't hold a candle. They're such rank amateurs compared to Hitler and Mao and Stalin. And his point, I think, was if you just take the, you know, you take the index card, I mean, murder is really the keystone. I mean, there's all kinds of injustice in the world and bad things, evil, but, you know, the gold standard for evil is cold-blooded murder. And for that, nobody can touch government. And he said, look, you ask me if we got rid of government, what would we replace it with? And he said, who cares? There's no way we could have had a quarter of a billion people murdered in cold blood, even if there was, you know, gang warfare everywhere over the whole planet. It was there's no way any situation could possibly be as bad as the one we're living in. So give it a chance.
I'm going to correct you on one thing. Hitler, Stalin, and Mao killed very few people with their own hands. It was those that were obedient to authority that did it. Those that just followed orders.
They all contribute.
Well, then we'll absolve those three gentlemen.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum. Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
This is all being done completely, totally, without any government permission, no licenses, except, of course, the BIPCOT no-gov license. Isn't that right?
Living and breathing anarchy. Bringing freedom into our lives.
And, you know, bringing freedom. Yeah, and bringing freedom into our lives. The one thing I love about the BIPCOT no-government license is that it seems to have applicability to so many parts of our lives, so that, you know, when I was at Pork Fest, people were, if someone fell asleep in the during the Freedom Fiends broadcast, you know, they would lay a copy of a BIPCOT license in front of them and then take their picture asleep. And that photograph, you know, is covered by the license. And there's so many things that you can use that on. And not that it does a blessed thing, because, you know, we don't mention what's in the license very often. Lou, you know what the sanction is for violating the license, right?
Public ridicule.
Public ridicule, yes. Shunning, shaming, just whatever laughter that we can bring about upon you for violating that license.
But we do that to government regardless of whether they use our material or not.
Yes, we do. They didn't know that before you said it. But every time you do this, it reminds us all. Well, first of all, it reminds us of the ridiculousness of the state and how they are just pompous, bloated tyrants who don't deserve any respect, any honor, because of the they have to use violence and coercion to get us to do anything. Every law is backed up by a violent punishment. When I was a prosecutor, every once in a while, a cop would bring me something they wanted to be filed as a crime, and I would look through the books, and the legislature, they screw up from time to time, they would forget to put a punishment next to the thing, you shall not, you know, stand on one foot on a Tuesday, and somebody did that, and you'd have to tell the cop, I was sort of delighted to do it, say, I can't file this, there's no punishment, there's no way the state can hurt you for not standing on your one foot. And that's the bellwether of everything they do. There's a punishment to hurt people, and they're just ridiculous.
Well,
so I love the BIPCOT license
every day.
Yeah, then they're ridiculous. I laugh at them. I despise them.
Internet terrorism. Now, when you think terrorism, you think bombs going off. You think all kinds of crazy things. But no, terrorism is people in the comments section of your Tumblr site or your YouTube video. I have a YouTube channel, Feminism LOL. I get all kinds of vitriol written in there, but that's not terrorism. That's just free speech. People don't like me, they're welcome to say so. I still get subscribers anyways. And yet, no, it's turning into a crackdown crime, and they're setting, you know, all kinds of rules now for Facebook. Twitter is going to, you know, people are getting their accounts deleted. They don't even know why. And the internet right now is one of the places we have that's not very governed, and we like it that way. But that's going to end, and you got to use your voice. That's one of the things that we're fighting against is apathy. Get out, start talking, and insist on your right to talk. They're just words. You didn't hurt anyone. You didn't throw a bomb at anyone. You just used a few words. And they can be brilliant words that touch people's minds and change the world. And if you don't start using that voice, you're going to lose it. because social justice is coming for your voice.
Now, speaking of words, there are words that you hear a lot more of and a lot less of. It's not very often that I hear somebody say, well, it's still a free country, right? But something that I have heard with increasing frequency has been better no government than the government that we have today. And the government that we have today really hasn't changed a whole lot other than the technology and the ability to become oppressive. But a lot of people, there's a sharp rise in the number of libertarians and even anarchists, and they realize this because government keeps Feinsteining up. So as more people tend to disappear from the state, as they tend to drop out or lose faith in that horrible religion, it's kind of like a Facebook thread. After a certain point in time, the comments are going to stop. There's no certain time limit that's required. There's no certain number of comments. There's no certain type of comment. It just kind of happens on its own. And the religion of the state will happen quite the same way. So I would encourage people to write their own social contract and decide how they want to treat other people and how they expect to be treated.
And laugh at the other one.
Yeah. Neither the many should loot the few, nor the few loot the many. How about nobody loots anybody?
Worms. Create the world we want to see.